In choosing tonight's program, I noticed that there are important parts of C.P. Bach's musical output that are not included elsewhere on our symposium agenda. So in addition to illustrating the points of my talk, my program offers compositions from throughout Bach's career, which show how profoundly his keyboard idiom changed as his style evolved. I'd like to begin by playing a passage from one of his late works, followed by another from one of his earliest pieces. Many of you must have recognized my first example. It's from the Rondo in A minor, which we will hear tomorrow night. It's explicitly for the forte piano, and not only the detailed dynamic markings, but the octaves over here, and many of the chord voicings implicitly demand a dynamic instrument. My second example was a fragment from an early work, an early sonata, which I'll be playing, although it uses an idiom that we associate today with the harpsichord. This and other student works might have been played more frequently on the clavichord. It nevertheless lacks dynamic markings, and it's written largely in two contrapuntal parts, each confined to a limited tessitura and rhythmic texture. Now, by keyboard idiom, I mean not just a compositional style, but how the music seems to use a particular instrument, what sorts of performance style and technique it seems to call for. Clearly, these two pieces were written for and played on distinct instruments. Yet I don't plan to discuss the actual instruments on which this music was played or on which we might perform today. We wander into subjective territory when we try to establish for what specific instrument a piece was composed, or when we try to prove that a particular instrument is best for playing a piece today. As you all know, Emanuel Bach was best known during his lifetime and afterwards for his keyboard music. Therefore, it seems strange that he hardly ever specified the precise medium of this music. Instead, he used the German word Klavier or the Italian word cembalo, neither of which then referred to any specific instrument. Thus, the six famous collections for Kenner und Liebhaber, which he published towards the end of his life, are mainly for the generic clavier. Only the 13 rondos within these collections are specifically for forte piano. A few other works call for Beibung, a sort of vibrato obtainable on the clavichord and related instruments. You see the notation for Beibung here. This is from the first set of pieces for Kenner and Liebhaber, a sonata in F major. Let me demonstrate that for you. Those, I don't know if you can see them, there are little dots over some of the notes. That's the indication for Beibung. Starting at the top there. Thank you. That's one of very few pieces which seems to require clavichord by virtue of its use of that particular effect. Now, Bach also wrote a few other pieces for special instruments, but all of these compositions are also playable on ordinary instruments. And indeed, Bach and his contemporaries must have been prepared to perform keyboard music on whichever of the great variety of 18th century instruments was available. This may explain the puzzling fact that just as Bach rarely specified the instruments for which his keyboard pieces are intended, he wrote very little about keyboard touch or playing technique in his famous book, The Versuch, or Essay on Playing Keyboard Instruments. Still, Bach's music, more than that of any other 18th century composer, reveals fundamental changes over the course of his career in how he wrote for keyboard instruments. And we saw that in those two pieces that I started with. These changes must reflect equally fundamental changes in how he played the instruments. Now, Forkel, in his biography of J.S. Bach, elaborated upon the sketchy instructions for keyboard touch given by Emmanuel in his essay. From this, modern harpsichordists have concluded that J.S. Bach's technique involved drawing the fingers back like this, rather than striking the keys vertically. Following Emmanuel Bach's instructions, harpsichordists today assume that notes that do not bear slurs are generally played non-legato, and these harpsichordists use so-called silences of articulation to create agogic accents. Yet it's hard to apply these practices without modification to keyboard pieces that were composed over a period of close to a century and were played on very different instruments. My very first piece must date from the composer's student years at Leipzig or Frankfurt on the Oder, no later than 1735. The one complete manuscript copy designates it as a sonata for cembalo. Yet, this piece is what we would call a suite. It opens with an allemande, a dance, and it also includes two other dances, a polonaise and a minuet. There was at least one further movement, probably another dance, a courante, but a sheet is missing from the manuscript, and only the last 15 measures of this movement survive. I've reconstructed the opening, but apart from the ending, which I've already played for you, that was my second example, most of what you will hear of this movement is by me, not C.P.E. Bach. Even in the parts that C.P. Bach wrote, the keyboard idiom of this piece is indistinguishable from that of music by J.S. Bach from the same period. But whether that points to any specific instrument is hard to say. The polonaise may sound familiar. Emmanuel copied the same piece into the second little keyboard manuscript of his stepmother, Anna Magdalena Bach. And there you see C.P. Bach's own score of this piece. This polonaise is one of Emmanuel's early compositions that Christoph Wolff mentioned this morning. This piece was once thought to be by J.S. Bach, but one is more likely to hear echoes of Sebastian's music in the other movements of this suite, including the fragmentary courante that I played at the beginning. The minuet of the suite closely resembles the minuet in Sebastian's G major partita. Both pieces are written for crossing hands. Here's the minuet from the G major partita of J.S. Bach. And at the bottom there, you see the minuet by Emmanuel Bach from this early suite. So clearly, People in the Bach household were playing minuets in G with crossing hands around 1730, which is when Sebastian published that piece at the top. Pieces such as this originated in the French Baroque tradition, where they were often meant for expensive double manual harpsichords. Yet Emmanuel and his fellow students are more likely to have played such music on an inexpensive clavichord, and nothing in the music requires a two-manual instrument. During the 1740s, however, after Emmanuel moved to Berlin, one begins to notice a division in his music between large, densely scored virtuoso pieces and simpler ones. During these years, the 1740s, he emerged as a leading composer and player of keyboard music, writing dozens of sonatas and concertos and issuing his first publications. Many of the sonatas employ a distinctive new idiom, yet again it remains difficult to associate this with any of the new types of instruments that he must have been playing during this period. My second piece was the last of six sonatas published in 1744 with a dedication to the reigning Duke of Württemberg. Its first movement is full of dramatic pauses and contrasts of style and rhythm, and these are often marked by changing dynamics. Here's the opening of that piece in the original edition, which I'll play later tonight. The slow movement is equally expressive and similarly broken up in many respects by rests and changes of dynamics and rhythm and so forth. And yet in the final movement of this sonata, Emmanuel reverts to the style of his father. The final movement is actually a big two-part invention. Now, this sonata seems to have been a favorite of the composer's. He discusses it in his essay. It's one of the very few specific pieces that he actually writes about in the Versuch. And at some point, Emmanuel wrote out embellishments as well as a cadenza for the first two movements. The cadenza is played at the end of the second movement. Some of these variations may have been intended to be played in the repeated sections of the first movement. Known as varied reprises, such embellishments were customarily improvised, and they were one of the attractions of Bach's own performances. Variation and embellishment were essential elements of both his compositional method and his performance practice. He eventually published an entire collection of six sonatas with varied reprises. This piece, however, is the earliest one for which we have Bach's variations, and I'm going to incorporate them into my performance tonight. So here, for example, is the opening of the first movement. I'm showing you the original version over here, which I'll play the first time around. When I get to the repeat sign, I'll go back to the beginning and I'll play this. So what you will hear the first time is the piece as Emmanuel published it in 1744. And then on the repeat, you'll hear the varied reprises. And hopefully I'll play a little better than that later tonight. Today, these Württemberg sonatas are usually played and recorded as harpsichord pieces, although we heard a very poised performance of the first one today, this afternoon, on a Ferrini piano. And in fact, two of these sonatas have three dynamic levels, not only piano and forte, but also pianissimo. This rules out simply dividing the music between the two manuals of a harpsichord, one loud and one soft. That's only one of several things that raise questions about the keyboard idiom of these sonatas. In any case, it's already far removed from the idiom of Emmanuel's music of the previous decade. Now, even if Emmanuel did not have a specific instrument in mind for these pieces, some lesser works from a few years later might have been composed specifically for students to play at the clavichord. Here, for example, are several passages from an easy sonata, relatively easy, of 1750. Dynamic markings are absent. Yet the clavichord is suggested by the free alternation between a single line and two-note chords in either hand. The chords sometimes lie low in the accompaniment, and they produce a rumble on the harpsichord. In the andante, a clavichord is more likely than a harpsichord to produce singing tones on the melody there. And later in the same movement, there's a rising line here which clearly implies a crescendo, and in fact, that's the expressive high point of the entire sonata. Let me just show you what that sounds like on the clavichord. That would probably work on harpsichord. The andante less so. And then this crescendo passage. Now, of course, you can play that on the harpsichord, and I wouldn't claim that this really is a clavichord piece, but certainly it's an idiom that seems more suited to the clavichord and other dynamic instruments. And that's my main point, is that the idiom of the music has changed. And the presence of explicit dynamic markings isn't necessary to indicate that idiom. It's evident in the notes themselves. Tomorrow we're going to hear Bach's G minor sonata of 1746. Which incorporates passages in the style of a fantasia. We'll also hear an actual fantasia in E-flat from the same period. And here's a bit of Emanuel Bach's manuscript of that fantasia. As you can see, the fantasia here has four levels of dynamic markings: piano, pianissimo, mezzo forte, and forte, and they all occur within a single line. So there's no way you're going to produce those changes of dynamics on a harpsichord. You need a fully dynamic instrument, whether it's a clavichord or a forte piano. It's tempting to associate this piece, this fantasia, with the Silbermann clavichord that Bach acquired around this time, or with the forte pianos that his employer, King Frederick the Great, was now collecting. But the idiom of Emanuel's keyboard music had already been evolving in this direction for some time. Now, Bach apparently reserved some of this music, including the fantasia, for his own use. It didn't circulate, not even in manuscript copies. But when he published the first volume of the essay in 1753, the treatise was accompanied by 18 Probestücke, or practice pieces. Andrew Willis talked about them this afternoon. These Probestücke were graded exercises in the new keyboard idiom, progressing from simple to complex and grouped into six sonatas. I've chosen to play the third sonata from the collection. Apart from the ornaments, nothing here may strike a modern pianist as particularly notable, although Andrew did point out occasional things in the fingering, which Emanuel indicates, which are a little different from what a modern pianist would do. Certain other details signify the composer's distancing himself from the keyboard idiom of his father's generation. For instance, in the very first measure, staccato dots fall on the second and third beats. I'm not sure if you can see them, but these two notes here are staccato. Elsewhere, we find staccato dots at the ends of phrases, even on downbeats, such as over here on this note. Indications of these types are very rare in older keyboard music, and not all harpsichordists today would view these particular notes as appropriate places for staccato. This is because detaching a note on the harpsichord doesn't make it louder or more emphatic. It wouldn't make this downbeat any stronger. It just makes the note shorter. In his essay, however, Bach doesn't describe these notes as staccato. He uses the German word gestossen. This is the same word that Quantz, the flutist, used for notes that receive an extra impulse on the flute. To a violinist, this word might suggest pressing the bow sharply into the string. The word has a similar implication on the clavichord, where the keys are in direct contact with the tangents that produce the sound. So Bach's staccato signs imply a particular type of accent. You dig into the string. You do also shorten the note, but it's a new type of touch unique to dynamic keyboard instruments. On the other hand, the third movement of the same sonata retains a notational convention from harpsichord music. Here, the opening theme is accompanied by slurred broken chords in the left hand. And Bach tells us that the notes beneath the slurs should be sustained. Andrew actually mentioned this earlier today in another piece. This was a convention from older French Baroque harpsichord music. These slurs, which, by the way, Bach added at a very late stage of preparing this piece for publication, these slurs produce a regular alternation between slurred and detached notes in the accompaniment. That type of detailed articulation is typical of mid-18th century chamber music, and it remains a part of Bach's keyboard idiom to the very end of his career, but probably not that of his younger contemporaries. Now, this piece was published probably in 1753. Bach's keyboard music of the period includes many other elegant pieces such as this one, but it also includes much more heavily scored pieces that imitate the new genre of the symphony. Some of these symphonic sonatas, as we might call them, are surprisingly close in style to that of Johann Christian Bach, Emmanuel's younger half-brother. Christian studied with Emmanuel in Berlin from 1750 to 1755. He probably played these very pieces. Here is the opening of one of Emmanuel's symphonic sonatas from the same period, from 1755. And if you know any of Johann Christian Bach's music or some of the pieces that were played beautifully yesterday, this sounds just like Christian Bach. But this is Emmanuel Bach. Although not very profound, this piece might have made a splendid effect on several English harpsichords with special stops that King Frederick was acquiring during this period. Christian Bach would have remembered this when he got to England. I've chosen to play a refined example of this type of sonata from 1758. An important part of this symphonic idiom, already found in earlier works, is the so-called drum bass, consisting of repeated notes. You see it at the very beginning of this piece, and this too was mentioned in one of the talks earlier today. It's a very uninteresting bass line. J.S. Bach almost never wrote this sort of thing, nor did Haydn, Mozart, or Beethoven in their keyboard music, although it's common in their orchestral works. But this is an essential part of Emmanuel Bach's keyboard idiom throughout his career. This type of bass line need not be played mechanically. And I wanted to mention that as a college student, I once performed with my classmate Yo-Yo Ma in one of Haydn's cello concertos. Strangely enough, what I remember from that performance, what made an impression on me, was not Yo-Yo's playing in the solos. It was the way he played the drum basses in the orchestral passages. Even plain repeated notes can be made expressive, particularly on a dynamic instrument. Andrew, earlier today, repeated for us Bach's famous advice to musicians, don't play like a trained bird. This rule can apply to the bass as well as the melody. The crescendos and diminuendos that are implied throughout Emmanuel's keyboard music, light and shade, as he and Quantz put it, these things can be incorporated into bass lines and inner voices. So at the beginning of this sonata, you don't have to just pound out forte repeated notes if the next dynamic marking is piano. Those notes can gradually grow softer. This particular sonata opens quietly, and then it repeats the initial phrase, pianissimo. Beginning a piece softly, especially a piece in symphonic style, was an innovative gesture. It probably required a piano to achieve its full effect. But in any case, it marks a new stage in the evolution of Bach's keyboard idiom. Okay, we're back. This new flexibility in the use of dynamics becomes even clearer in the slow movement of this sonata. This movement is a sort of character piece, such as Bach had taken to writing several years earlier. The title, the Einschnitt, means something like the fragment. It refers to little echoes, usually in contrasting dynamics, piano, forte, piano, these little fragments of phrases which often appear without a break. So once again, he's assuming the use of a dynamic instrument. Equally telling is a passage near the end of this particular movement. It's a little hard to see here, but the music becomes pianissimo, and yet he's writing in as many as five voices, four maybe, but with the bass doubled. That's something that a modern pianist wouldn't think twice about, but it's impossible on the harpsichord. On the harpsichord, if you have a five-note chord, it's going to be loud. But Bach clearly wants a very special, quiet effect here. To play this, by the way, on clavichord or piano requires a rather different technique from the harpsichord. I think one needs arm and hand weight, which you control like a modern pianist, in order to create a piano. This is something that's never discussed, as far as I know, in writings of the 18th century, and yet it must have been something that players like Emmanuel Bach were learning to do. His keyboard idiom continued to evolve during his last two decades at Hamburg. There he published, among other works, the famous pieces for Kenner und Liebhaber, which means connoisseurs and amateurs. Pieces were for both. Because those pieces are relatively well known, I've chosen to play instead three late works that Bach left unpublished. The first of these is a sonata in C major. There you see it, in Bach's own manuscript. This is one of Bach's last sonatas, composed around the time that he was publishing 13 keyboard trios. Yet Bach left this piece in manuscript. One reason may be that even by the standards of his late works, this is unusually free and unpredictable. It shifts even more rapidly than before between different rhythmic textures. And like most of his late sonatas, it's highly compressed. The three movements are played without a break. Yet the keyboard idiom of this sonata is close to that of the rondos and fantasias for Kenner und Liebhaber, which Bach began writing 3 years later. This piece avoids the octaves that I showed you in my very first example, and it also lacks the extended sequences of broken chords that occur quite frequently in the rondos. These passages recall Bach's concertos. Still, in its shifting from one keyboard texture to another, the sonata marks the culmination of a trend that had marked Bach's keyboard writing since the 1740s. And here I've shown you a a transcription of the opening of that sonata with a sort of analysis underneath the original text. Particularly notable here is the frequent interruption of both the melody and the bass line by rests, as well as by changes in rhythm and register. So here's the opening of the piece as it was actually written, as it appeared in that manuscript that I showed you a few moments ago. The bass line is really just this. It's a scale, but it's broken up by rest, changes the dynamic level. The same goes for the melody. The dynamic markings, interpreted literally, will exaggerate that fragmentation. Some of those dynamic markings may indicate so-called terraced dynamics, sudden alternations between loud and soft, as in harpsichord music. But some others of these dynamic markings imply a gradual shift in dynamic level. So on the second system there, where it goes, becomes piano, I could make a sudden forte there, or I could make a crescendo. And the crescendo, I find more expressive. It brings out that chromatic step within the bass line. It turns this into a real phrase instead of a bunch of little fragments. The use of dynamics to bring out musical lines that lie beneath the fragmentation of the surface may be particularly important in C.P. Bach's late works, which otherwise can seem disjunct or merely capricious. This technique, using dynamics to make the piece cohere, seems to me to be an important element in Bach's keyboard idiom, even though it's rarely marked explicitly and never mentioned in his writings. Nowhere does this use of dynamics seem more critical than in his fantasias, which as early as the 1740s must have been conceived primarily for clavichord or fortepiano. In a letter of 1775, Bach mentioned his decision to publish popular piano trios and not what he called dark fantasias. The six fantasias in the Kenner und Liebhaber sets, composed during the following decade, are all in major keys. But among his very last keyboard works is a fantasia in F sharp minor. This fantasia, like the C major sonata, alternates rapidly between sharply contrasting textures. But whereas the sonata is comic in character, this fantasia seems terribly dark. Includes several, indeed, several passages seem to quote one of Bach's late songs, and this song is a contemplation of death. The fantasia ends with one of those passages. The fantasia nevertheless incorporates lively passages and broken chords, as in the rondos. Bach, moreover, arranged this fantasia for keyboard and violin, and in adapting it, he added a much lighter second movement. The arrangement as a whole bears the title C.P.E. Bach's Empfindungen, in other words, C.P.E. Bach's Sentiments. This title has been taken very seriously by most commentators, but I suspect that Bach meant it to be taken ironically. Certainly the fantasia alone expresses an enormous range of sentiments. Still, rather than end with a dark fantasia, I've chosen to conclude with a set of variations, also from Bach's late period. Despite the importance of variations for Bach, he left only a few sets of variations as such, and most are for beginners. This work is an exception. Bach published it in 1777 in a collection of what we would call piano trios for keyboard, violin, and cello. It's based on a little arioso that Bach had written for solo keyboard. The arioso is in binary form, as is each of the variations. Each half of each variation is therefore repeated. But at some point, Bach wrote out varied reprises, that is, variations of each of the variations. And that's what you're going to hear tonight. So here is the opening of the piece. The bottom system shows the original version for keyboard with violin and cello. So here's the keyboard part, here's the violin, and down here the cello. When you repeat this theme, however, as is indicated by the repeat sign here, I'm going to be playing this variation up here, which, as you can see, has a lot more notes than the original. Those notes don't actually work with the violin and cello part, and that tells us that Bach must have played this as a keyboard solo, and in fact the string parts are optional. This looks like piano music, and yet we know that Bach performed these keyboard trios on the clavichord. A contemporary critic reported that Emmanuel was accompanied by muted violin and a cello played with discretion. So these string parts are optional, and you can play all of Bach's piano trios as keyboard solos. The embellishments that Bach added to this particular work are a tour de force, not only of the art of variation, but of the flexibility and fluidity of the keyboard idiom in his late style.